I'm Jan Carson from Catholic Charities in Maryland, and my co-chair is on the line, Christiana Lynch from Devereux. So both of us are going to be facilitating the call today, and we're so pleased to have with us Julia Finken from the Joint Commission. Julia is the Executive Director for Behavioral Health Care for the Joint Commission, and Scott Williams will be joining us. He is the Director of Health Services Research. So, Scott, if you're not on the call yet, we'll welcome you when you join us. So, Julia, just for your information for the call, this committee has members from all across the country, from Alaska to Florida and every place in between. So you could hear the beeps as people were calling in. I think there's quite a few people with us today, and we're, again, delighted to have you with us. It's always important for us to be able to talk with you directly and get our, good ideas and concerns out and be able to have the discussion. So thanks for joining us today.
Sure, it's my pleasure. I wanted to check, am I sharing my screen for the slides, or are you going to be projecting those?
We sent them out to the membership, so they're going to be following along.
Okay, great. Just want to make sure that they have the information.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me here. It's always a pleasure to talk to NACBH constituents. And as I go along, I'm going to try to be fairly brief. I think Scott has a little bit more material prepared, and I want to make sure we get to everything that he has. What I did is I took the questions that the committee posed and tried to really just answer those questions. So if anything else comes up, please don't hesitate to ask me as we move along. So with that,
Julia,
forgive
me for interrupting. I forgot to do one little housekeeping, and I hear some background noise. So if people who are not speaking, could you put your phone on mute? As long as there's no music that comes on when you mute your phone, that'll be great. It'll help help with the background noise as Julia is presenting. Thank you. Okay, Julia, thanks.
Okay, no problem. So the first question you all posed was to get an update about what is going on with our Professional Technical Advisory Committee. So I wanted to give you an update. You may all be aware that as of last year, our Standards and Survey Procedures Committee, which was a committee of the board, was essentially dissolved January 1st of 17. And we placed all of our PTACs on hold as we developed an advisory structure. And really the intent of doing that was to really strengthen the advisory structure that we're utilizing to get input into what the Joint Commission is doing, whether that is related to standards and survey process or just the direction that we're moving in terms of responding to needs conveyed by the industry or regulatory bodies or any other interested party. We really wanted to make sure that we're hearing from all of the interested parties. So we really developed an enhanced behavioral health advisory group, and we actually developed advisory groups for all of the Joint Commission programs, whether that is hospitals or home care, nursing care center, laboratory. We really wanted to make sure that each of the programs had a very strong advisory structure. This is with the goal, again, of making sure that we have input from key national stakeholder groups, but we wanted to be very sure that we did not lose some of the things that that we have already had in place, and that was some of the more technical input into standards language and standards development. So we developed and are developing what we call technical advisory panels So as issues come up, as these advisory groups are identifying the need for us to look at particular standards or develop particular standards, we could then convene a group at that point made up of experts in the particular field that we're addressing and use that group in a very focused manner to advise on standards development. So in essence, kind of taking a lot of the standard work that we used to do in the PTAC and really put those into expert panels that could be convened at any point in time as needed. And then we also are continuing the use of our standard field reviews. So if you followed the work that we do with standards, we always put standards out for field review to get input from all interested parties. So the Behavioral Health Care Advisory Council that's being developed has some additional opportunities for input than perhaps we focused on before. So we really want to hear from this group things, feedback about what resources we need to develop to support our behavioral health care accredited organizations and people who are interested in becoming accredited. You know, what are the industry trends that we need to strengthen what we're doing in response to? Some we may not be responding to at all, and we need to understand what those needs are. We want to make sure that we are having an impact on improving the quality and safety of the care, treatment, and services that are provided to your clients, to the individuals that you serve. And there will be some input related to standards, policies, and products. And in particular, the standards would be at a very high, somewhat high level. And then the recommendation to convene an expert panel. We want to make sure we're getting information about everything that we're doing, changes, new processes, out to the field in the most effective, efficient manner. We would use this group to help us to figure out how to do that. In response to what we're hearing from the advisory group, what we're understanding about the industry, what we're hearing from the clients that you serve, we want to have the opportunity to work with this advisory council to develop new products and new services to help address those needs, and then also looking at the strategic direction. So the way that we have structured the advisory council is we really limited it to 15 individuals. But we are looking at those advisory councils very, very closely to make sure that we have representation from providers, large and small, complex and not complex, that we have the voice of the association on those advisory councils, payers, regulatory bodies, and any other interested parties across the country. We want to make sure that we have representation across all of the behavioral health care programs, services, and settings. So whether that is mental health or substance use disorder, children and youth, child welfare, intellectually disabled, and eating disorders. We want outpatient settings, residential settings, case management. So we're really looking very hard at getting that representation. And so as you can imagine, with having 15 individuals on that panel, we have organizations, and we have individuals on there that serve or wear multi-hats. So they may be a provider representative who's also on an association, and maybe that provider has multiple types of services and settings. So each individual will serve a term of 2 years. In our inaugural term, we're actually making 50% of the membership 2-year terms and 50% 3-year terms, so we don't turn over the entire advisory council after the first 2 years. These individuals can have a maximum of 3 consecutive 2-year terms, and we're planning on meeting once in person, once a year in person, and then having 3 conference calls per year. And the first meeting we're targeting to have is in May of this year. And that in-person meeting will actually convene all of the advisory councils across all of the Joint Commission programs. So we'll have advisory councils from hospitals, behavioral, nursing care centers, home care. So everyone will be represented. That gives us an opportunity to convey some information across all of the advisory councils, and then the majority of the time will be broken out by individual programs. And there'll be some networking opportunities as well between programs. So we're hoping that is a good format to kick our activities off with. Before I move into the compliance issues, I can take a second if there are questions, or we can hold questions till the end. Do you have a preference, Pat?
I think as we go is good.
Okay.
So, Julia, this is Jan Carson. Have the people been identified, the individuals? They know that they're on the advisory councils now?
So we just finalized the roster of individuals that we are reaching out to, and so we're just starting to reach out in the next couple of weeks. So no one at this point has been approached yet and asked to sit on the council.
Okay. Okay, great. It sounds great. The new structure sounds very promising.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Julia, this is Steve Drilly. A question that I had is, what's the interface between the TAPS and the advisory council?
So the information that comes out of the advisory council in terms of what recommendations for what types of topics that there should be TAPS developed, then that would go through our Department of Survey or Standards and Survey Methods. So instead of a board group kind of being the hub of that activity, it's actually now our Department of Standards and Survey Methods. So those recommendations would go to that group. They would convene the appropriate TAPs, and then that information would come back to the advisory council so that you know where we are with your recommendations.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Sure.
Julia, this is Chrissy Lynch from Devereaux. I know you were talking about communication. Will you be communicating out to the Joint Commission world after the May 2018 in-person meeting to talk about the summary of what was covered?
You know, that's a really good question, Christy. I don't know that we had set up a mechanism where we would make those what's done in the Advisory Council public to all of the Joint Commission accredited organizations, but I'll bring that back to the group, and then I can let you all know where we go with that.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, am I okay to go on?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so there was a question about the top compliance issues for 2017, and so I wanted to show you all that these top compliance issues are actually listed in perspectives, and it was in the September 2017 issue. a Perspective magazine. And so because of time constraints, I can't spend a huge amount of time, but just wanted to point out that these have been fairly consistent over the past couple of years. Sometimes they jockey for position in our top 10 or 11, but these are the recurring themes. So we still see that the plan of care, treatment, and service is number one. That tends to stay there. About 50% of our organizations that we survey have a finding within this standard. And really, this standard relates to having a clear identification of the assessed needs of the individual that you're serving, and then developing goals that are related to these assessed needs. And so there should be a clear relation between what the assessed needs are and the needs that the plan of care is developed around. And we want to make sure that those identified goals that are developed are really written in a way that captures the client's words and ideas, and it's not in professional talk. As you all know, the standards are meant to be very patient-centered, and we want to make sure that the goals developed have relevance and meaning to the client that you're working with. We want to make sure that there are clear objectives that really identify the steps needed to sufficiently assess the client's progress towards goals. And we want to make sure that the client is proceeding forward, or those goals are reevaluated and changed. Some of the states may have required timeframes for reevaluation, or the organization may have a minimum time frame. But at a minimum, whenever there's a significant change in the client's status, we want to make sure that those goals are reevaluated and revised as needed. All of the assessed needs should have a plan that fits into the category of either you're treating, you're deferring, or you're referring the client out. And then, of course, we want to make sure the treatment plan is followed. The second one I want to touch on, HRM 121, and this is really assuring that your staff are qualified and competent, and we want to make sure that the organizations are conducting primary source verification, so going on to online databases for licensing, certification, or registration, not accepting photocopies from staff, and making sure that you download and retain documentation. And also the health screening, the surveyors look to make sure health screening is done in accordance with law and regulation and or organization policy. And then the National Practitioner Database is an important component of this and can be problematic for very small organizations. So right now, querying the National Practitioner Database only applies to physicians and dentists for behavioral health care. We want to make sure you query every 2 years, and this is done by organization staff. For some of our smaller organizations, it's difficult for them to meet the criteria in order to access that database. So we have told organizations that we will accept that the practitioner themselves comes in to the organization. An HR person can see them query their own information and then go ahead and download and print that information and then have the HR person sign off and date it as a witness. Another one I wanted to talk about, and you had mentioned specifically, was the National Patient Safety Goal regarding suicide risk reduction. And that has not been any material changes to that goal, but a few things I wanted to mention is to make sure that for behavioral health care clients that an assessment is done, a full assessment, a screening does not meet this standard. We want to make sure that you're identifying the specific characteristics of the individual and also the environment that may add to the risk, and then determine the risk and take appropriate action. And I have included a little bit further later in my presentation a little bit more about some of the recommendations that came out of our that are coming out of our suicide risk reduction expert panel. So with that, I just wanted to mention kind of a three out of the top four. But we do have a webinar replay posted on our website that goes in depth over these challenging standards. And that was from last July of 17. And then we have an upcoming webinar July 10th of this year where we'll again go over the top compliance issues. We do have some new things that came into the revision of the CMBHC manual. I just wanted to mention we have a new safety system for individuals served a whole chapter. We've done some consolidation and movement in human resource management, infection control, and the rights of the individual chapters. We've revised a couple of medication management standards and the life safety and environment of care. I just want to mention for the medication management, the main change is that we incorporated hazardous medication into one of the standards, MMO 10103. And this just talks about the organization defining a process to manage, implement a policy and process for hazardous medication. And there's a list that can be found online at www.cdc.gov. And that can help you inform you on what medication you might have on your premises that you need to make some a policy and processes around. Also wanted to point out, and this was in the BHC news, that there was a revision to life safety chapter in the manual. And essentially, we updated to the NFPA 101 life safety code, the most recent code. And so, there were not really material changes, more edits to the standards to bring them up to current practice and date.
Julia?
Uh-huh.
Leanne Gardner from Devereaux. I had a couple questions regarding the top standards and compliance data. You were going through a lot of the specifics. Are those covered in this CAMBHC manual and standards? Because the examples you were giving were very good. I'm just wondering where that, you know, clarification are available.
Okay, sure. So in the some of what I mentioned are in the standards language, right in the elements of performance.
Okay.
All of it that I mentioned was in the, you can find in the webinar replay from the July 2017 webinar. And there's some good, that was done by Merlin Wessel, our standards interpretation group resource for behavioral health care. And he gives some really good examples there as well and mentions much of what I mentioned here.
Okay. And then I had one question on the one standard about the influenza vaccine and staff. I know the Joint Commission has set 90% compliance of staff in an organization have to have their influenza vaccination. However, I mean, there are issues now coming out about healthcare organizations that are being sued trying to demand mandatory immunization. And so how does a center or an organization address this, trying to comply with the Joint Commission's expectation of a 90%, when in fact there's the chance of litigation for putting these kinds of policies in place?
Yeah. So, and I'm just pulling, I'm looking here for exactly how the standard is worded, but
I think
it talks about the opportunity for to decline and making sure that educating staff regarding the benefits and risks. Ultimately, they do have the right to decline.
But the standard, I thought, said that 90% had to be by 2020. And so that's the only thing I'm concerned with, is because we're not going to be able to, you know, reach that given, you know, these other issues. And I just want to make sure that when we go through an accreditation, we don't get, you know, a mark against us for that. So I just want to know how we should.
Well, I think that's a very good point. And people have very strong feelings about this. And even after you do many educations, they still have strong feelings about it. And, of course, all publicity and that happens just reinforces that. And I think this is a very important issue for the Joint Commission to take a look at.
Yeah, let me take that back. I was trying to look at the language to see if it I think it's striving, the way it's worded is striving to achieve a 90% compliance. My understanding is as long as all of the steps are taken to continually try to increase the number of individuals and the percentage of your staff that are getting the influenza vaccine, I believe that you're compliant with the standard. But let me take that back and make sure that I'm interpreting that correctly.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure. No problem. Okay. All right. The suicide prevention expert panel, there were some recommendations related to the settings of residential partial hospitalization, day treatment, and intensive outpatient. And probably the biggest recommendation is that these settings are not required to be ligature resistant. However, they want to make sure that there's a risk assessment of the individual and the environment to make sure that those individuals that you're serving are in, you know, a safe environment, and as their status changes, as their plan of care changes, if they should, you know, that there's an ongoing assessment to make sure that the risk of self-harm is mitigated. And that, and these are posted in detail in the perspective in the November issue of Perspective. The last thing I wanted to mention, and then I want to turn it over to Scott, he joined us a few minutes ago, is just you had asked for an update on survey timeliness. So I wanted to let you know that at this point, we just ran our data. 87% of initial surveys are within 90 days of their ready date. And this is an improvement from last year, where we were running about 56%. In October of 17, we were at 56%. We're within 90 days. So we've made some significant gains in that area. In terms of resurveys, 57% of the resurveys are on time, but 27% are late, less than 30 days. And then 25% are still more than 30 days late. In our statistics for that from October is that we had 56. Oh, let's see. I'm sorry. Let me get those for the resurveys. Oh, 75. I'm sorry. In October, 48% were on time or within 30 days of the due date. 52% were greater than 30 days late. So We've made some inroads. We're still striving to get better. Our goal is to have no surveys late and to get our initials down to within 60 days. And so we've hired last year 17 behavioral health care surveyors and 6 psychiatric hospital surveyors. Already this year, we have 5 additional behavioral health care surveyors hired. They just went through training in January, and we have 3 psychiatric hospital surveyors hired. So we've made some real gains in hiring and training qualified staff. We actually grew in the number of applications 53% over what we, in 17, we had 53% more applications than we had in 2016. We had 528 new organizations apply. So we're working to keep up with demand, and I'm hoping that you'll see some real improvements from last year in what you experienced this year.
With Thank that, you, Julia. That,
go ahead.
Yeah, this is Jan. I just that's phenomenal growth in the number of applications, and thanks for the great summary on where you are now.
You're welcome. With that said, I want to turn it over to Scott to provide him with some time to talk to all of you as well. Scott?
Yeah, thanks, Julia. I'm going to start by going over the revised standard, which was effective January 1st, 2018. I apologize to those on you on the phone who memorized this stuff, and this is going to be repetitive, but I think it's important to set some context here. For I don't know how many years the Joint Commission has had this Care Treatment and Service Standard 030109, which reads, the organization assesses the outcomes of care, treatment, or services provided to the individual served. It also had an EP, an element of performance, that read, the organization monitors the individual's progress in achieving her care, treatment, or service goals. So that standard has been modified, or more correctly, that first element of performance has been modified so that it now reads, the organization, and here's the modification, uses a standardized tool or instrument to monitor the individual's progress in achieving his or her care, treatment, or service goals. So there was not a huge change in terms of the expectation that organizations monitor outcomes for their individuals they serve, or that they monitor progress throughout the treatment process, but the big change is obviously that they now are required to do so using a standardized instrument or tool. The other EPs associated with this particular standard are the organization gathers and analyzes data generated through the standardized monitoring, and the results are used to inform the goals and objectives of the individual's plan of care, treatment, or services as needed. And then the third element of performance is that the organization evaluates the outcomes of care, treatment, or services provided to the populations it serves, and this part is new, by aggregating and analyzing the data gathered through the standardized monitoring effort. So obviously some big changes to that standard. No change to the requirement that care and progress be monitored, but definitely some changes in terms of being more prescriptive with respect to how one goes about monitoring that. So I'll get a little into the detail of how one would go about complying with the standard. So it's really intended to promote the use of what's called measurement-based care or routine outcome measurement. There are a number of different names for it. But in general, it refers to the process of using objective data as feedback during the course of services in order to monitor progress towards whatever the desired outcome is. So the data are used to inform care specifically for the individual being served, as well as to support quality improvement efforts for the organization. So there are a number of different kinds of instruments which will meet the requirement. Those instruments, they don't have to come, the Joint Commission has a list of instruments, but they don't have to come from that list. Any instrument that's used to meet the requirement should have well-established reliability and validity. And that's for use as a repeated measure. So there are a lot of instruments that are valid and reliable, but they aren't necessarily intended for use as a measurement-based care tool. They need to be sensitive to change. In other words, if you're going to use them to monitor progress, you need to know what a difference in scores from measurement point A to measurement point B really means. They need to be appropriate for use as a repeated measure, and they have to be capable of discriminating between populations that may or may not benefit from services, if that's appropriate. And that's the kind of thing where you might be able to distinguish between a clinical versus a non-clinical population, healthy or non-healthy, typical, non-typical, similar to patients seeking services or not similar to people seeking services. The kinds of measures that are not compliant with the standard may be very, very useful measures, but again, this is a very specific requirement. So a measure that assesses the use of evidence-based care or clinical practice guidelines can be really, really useful, but it's not a measurement-based care instrument. It's really looking to measure whether a specific process of care is being followed, not whether or not that process of care is having the desired effect. A perception of care measure or a patient satisfaction survey, again, also may be really, really useful for the organization to understand patient satisfaction or their perception of the care being provided. In some cases, these can be used to augment a measurement-based care instrument, especially when those perception of care measures address things like the clinical alliance. That can actually be really useful, but that in and of itself is not a measurement-based care tool. Because it doesn't directly address whether or not improvement is being made in terms of movement towards the desired outcome of care. Similarly, a measure of medication treatment compliance. Again, good to know whether patients or individuals served are following the recommendations of care, but that doesn't necessarily indicate that they're improving. So you could, for example, have someone who's being treated for depression routinely taking their medications as prescribed, but it may not have the effect that's desired. There are a sizable contingent of people who receive any form of treatment who don't improve, and it's really important that we identify who those folks are and modify treatment as necessary when they're not actually improving based on the services that are being offered. Similarly, an assessment of outcome after the completion of service is not a measure that would comply with the standard. So it addresses outcome, but if it's measuring it from admission to discharge, or at some subsequent point of measurement, 60 days past discharge, 6 months following discharge. Also very informative, useful information for the organization, especially as it tries to identify the effectiveness of its services for a population. But it's not measurement-based care, because if it's completed after the service has ended, there's no opportunity to monitor the service and the progress for the individual who's actually completing the instrument. So selecting a standard instrument. In June of 2017, the Joint Commission posted a list of instruments on our website. There's a web address in the handout that was provided as part of the meeting invite. I should make it clear that the Joint Commission doesn't endorse any specific instrument that's on the website. And the list isn't intended to be exclusive. We know there are other instruments out there which may be very useful as a measurement-based care tools. We're not trying to say you have to draw an instrument from this list, but you should be able to gather from the information provided by the instrument developers on this list whether or not that tool would provide you with the kind of information you would need for your population and your setting to be able to provide measurement-based care services. There are currently 51 instruments listed on the Joint Commission site. It's a pretty broad range of settings. Many of the instruments that are listed are non-proprietary. They're non-copyrighted. In some cases, there are copyrighted instruments on the list, but they don't necessarily require a fee to use, especially if you're using them in a paper-pencil format. And there are postings for individual instruments as well as for pretty comprehensive systems that may offer you a suite of instruments at your disposal. So it really depends on the needs of you and your organization in terms of how you go about selecting which instrument is right for you or which system may be right for you if that's the route you decide to go. So I'm going to get a little bit into how the Joint Commission evaluates compliance with the standard, but let me pause for just a second and see if there are any questions about the revised standard or the instruments that are appropriate for use.
Hi, this is Pat Wilcox. We asked this question before, but I just want to confirm that it is not necessary for the agency to use the same standard for all programs, that they can have different standards for different programs.
Absolutely. So depending on the populations you serve, it may be ideal for you to use multiple instruments. So one particular instrument for this setting or population, another instrument for that setting or population. And in some cases, it's okay to use a tool which is a more globally designed instrument, which may measure things like distress or functional status, which may cut across populations. It's really up to you and how you want to go about evaluating the care and effectiveness of the services you're providing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let me go into how the Joint Commission will evaluate compliance with the standard. So as we had talked about before, there are the three elements of performance. The first being that you're using a standardized tool or instrument. The second being that you're actually using data from that instrument to inform progress, inform goals and objectives and how individuals making progress towards those goals. And then that third element of performance addresses how the organization aggregates that data for quality improvement or evaluating the effectiveness of the services that it's providing at an organizational level. So I'll go through this by each element of performance, starting with the first. So the very first set of questions that surveyors are going to ask on site with respect to this standard are, what instrument or instruments have you selected? If the instrument has been selected from the Joint Commission list, the questions are a little bit easier from that point forward because the surveyors will immediately know that the instrument is appropriate for use. If it isn't coming from the list, it still may be totally appropriate, but they may have some additional questions for you to understand why the instrument was selected, how you evaluated whether or not it was appropriate for use as a measurement-based care tool. So they may ask you things about how do you know what the reliability and validity of the instrument is, how do you know it's appropriate for use as a repeated measure. They may ask how and when do staff administer the instrument, with what frequency is it re-administered to the individual served, how they know whether positive or negative change occurs. So in other words, what's the numeric value on the instrument that would signal reliable change? And are there populations of individuals who are not expected to complete the instrument? And if so, how do you monitor progress for those individuals? Is there a different tool or instrument you use for those folks? The next set of questions would be related to how the organization goes about actually implementing the instrument. So once the surveyors have established that an organization has selected a tool, they'll want to know what education or training was provided to staff in preparation for implementation. How was training provided? They'll want to know from staff generally, who are supposed to interpret the data. Do they know how to interpret the data? Do they know any of the key elements of the instrument, like when to administer it, what's the range of scores, what is reliable change considered to be on the instrument? And again, they'll want to know whether all populations served by the organization are measured by at least one objective instrument. For EP2, which is monitoring or using the data to monitor progress, surveyors are generally follow a patient tracer to identify compliance with that particular element of performance. So they'll want to know, do client records contain evidence that the instrument was correctly administered? They'll want to see whether progress notes indicate that the results were discussed with the individual served, especially if deterioration was observed. Now, I should make it clear that the progress notes don't have to say anything about how the instrument was used, but it's helpful if they do as evidence that the data are being used to help inform care. In other words, the absence of such documentation wouldn't necessarily indicate noncompliance, but the presence of that kind of information would be a pretty good indicator that the organization is compliant. They'll want to know if there's evidence that changes in treatment goals or objectives are related to or associated with or supported by the data. They may, through that patient tracer process, ask whether clients understand how the instrument is being used to monitor their progress. Has the particular client seen the instrument? Have they filled it out? What does it mean? Has anyone talked to them about the results of the instruments that they have filled out? They'll ask clinicians to describe how they've used the data to inform or modify treatment goals or objectives. They'll want to know how progress or deterioration is documented by clinicians. And then they may also use that patient tracer process to talk about supervision. So one of the ways that data may be used is to identify particularly difficult cases or cases where deterioration is taking place, and they'll want to know if supervisors can readily identify cases where a client wasn't making progress. If the data is being used from those instruments, it should be fairly easy for an organization to identify some of those treatment risk cases. They'll want to know whether treatment teams or supervisors discuss at-risk cases with clinicians. And they'll want to know something about our data being used to inform or trigger discussions at the level of service or changes to treatment plans and goals. So again, this is all just different ways to get at the same question. Is the organization, are the clinicians using the information that they're collecting? And then finally, for element of performance three, surveyors will ask questions mostly in the planning at this stage, because we don't expect organizations, having implemented this just on January 1st, to have a large pool of data that they can use to aggregate, but they'll want to know what the plans are for data aggregation and evaluation by the organization. They'll want to use, are there any plans, they'll want to know whether there are any plans to use the data to identify quality improvement opportunities, and if so, how. Are the data being used, or will the data be used, to evaluate clinician performance? If the answer to that is yes, they'll want to know how this is being done in a manner that's consistent with the safety culture. And then finally, they'll want to know what other ways the organization has used or plans to use the data. Generally speaking, when this standard or an element of performance associated with the standard is observed to be non-compliant, I don't know how familiar you are all with the SAFER matrix and how surveyors now score observations with respect to their likelihood of harm to patients, staff, or visitors, and the scope of those observations, whether it's limited or a pattern or widespread in scope. But generally speaking, any observations associated with any of the three elements of performance on this standard are going to be in the low risk but widespread category, because they're likely to affect the majority of patients, but they're not looking to put patients at additional harm. I mean, people haven't been doing this for a long time. You know, continued failure to implement it isn't going to put patients at dramatically greater risk. So for the time being, it's low risk. Although I would say we may get to a point in a few years where it becomes clear that the failure to implement these instruments, the failure to collect this kind of data and to use it to monitor progress, may be considered moderate risk. It may be considered a standard of practice which the organization isn't following. And then there's also those instances in which the organization may be collecting data, the data may point to significant deterioration or risk, and nothing is done about that, in which case ignoring warning signs that a patient is at risk for treatment failure may be considered to be moderate or high risk. But at this point, we really don't expect to see any of those scores outside of the low risk but widespread category. Finally, as surveyors are evaluating compliance with this particular standard, the observations associated with instrument selection and monitoring treatment progress and the use of data may also lead to questions that could be scored under some of the other chapters, including leadership and performance improvement and the record of care. That's really up to the surveyor and where that patient tracer leads them, but the failure to do certain things on this particular standard may point them towards other gaps or issues across the organization. But that's true for essentially any standard or element of performance that's identified during the tracer. One last point about this particular standard and the elements of performance associated with it. Julia had provided information about the 2017 compliance. I looked at the compliance issues associated with this particular standard, CTS 030109, and it falls squarely in the top 10 list. It's actually listed at number 5 in 2018. So between the first month and a half of scoring, this has become the fifth most scored standard on the list. Most of the other standards, as Julia had mentioned, are pretty consistent and haven't changed. In fact, the top four prior to this one, actually the top five, including this one, have not changed and are in the exact same order that Julia presented them for 2017. So lastly, I'll just sort of review and conclude here. The survey evaluation of the new standard is really about three things. It's about the organization having an instrument that's appropriate for measurement-based care. It's about confirming that they're using that consistently at multiple intervals in the care process. And most importantly, it's about actually looking at the data and doing something in response to it. That is essentially what the surveyors are doing, and anytime they can find a narrative that shows them that an instrument's being used, an organization is going to do just fine on this standard. Questions?
Scott, this is Pat Johnston at NACBH. Thanks for this really clear presentation. My question is it unusual for a new or substantially revised standard to immediately be one of the most problematic?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that question. Julia, do you have experience with that? Julia, are you still there?
You may have lost her. I heard a hang up.
Could you repeat the question? I didn't hear all of it.
The question was really about go ahead. Sorry.
Whether it's unusual for a new or substantially revised standard to show up right away as being difficult to comply with.
I don't have a data to support my impression of that, so I can't tell you definitively, but my sense is that it would not be that uncommon if it's a material change, something like this standard where, it's something that is very new that organizations have never done before. For that to pop up fairly early on as a challenging standard.
Yeah, I think one of the concerns of the committee members when we were putting our questions together for you last month was what surveyors are going to be looking for in the early stages of this revised standard being implemented versus later. I mean, it's new, there are new requirements here for everyone. So, is there any kind of, I know standards are standards and compliance is compliance, but is there any phasing in of expectations?
I would say we've talked to the surveyors about this in the education process, in preparing them to survey this particular standard. And yes, there is some leniency associated with how they would evaluate, especially the second two elements of performance. So the organization is expected to have selected an instrument at this point. And truthfully, as I'm looking at the observations, 85% of them are related to the organization hasn't selected an instrument. So that's a pretty cut and dry assessment for the surveyors to make. They know that there's not going to be a huge amount of data to work with, right from the get-go. I would imagine by June Their expectations will shift some since the organization should have an instrument in place since January. There will be more cases where there are multiple points of measurement, and they'll want to see how the clinicians are using those multiple points of measurement to evaluate the effectiveness of care. But in February, most clients who've had an instrument administered may not have even had a second administration, you know, upon which you could actually act or do something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. This is Jan. I think I got disconnected. I'm sorry if there was a disconnect in my question there, but I was following along, so that's good. Okay. Are there any other questions, comments for Julia or Scott?
I have a question. This is Jeff Gentry in San Antonio. I have a question for Julia about the anti-ligature as it applies to partial residential intensive outpatient day treatment. What about sort of conventional outpatient services, you know, services in office where we do psychotherapy and psychological assessment and medication management outpatient? Is the standard applied the same way there as for partial and other places like that?
So that technical advisory committee is continuing to meet, and so we don't have the specific recommendations for that setting yet. But I would expect it will be, you know, similar, that the individual is assessed for level of risk and the environment is assessed for level of risk and appropriate measures are taken. At that, you know, those individuals in the outpatient setting are, for the most part, going to have a much, you know, lower level of risk. And so the actions that would need to be taken to the environment, et cetera, I would expect are, you know, would be at a lower level as well.
Okay. So it might be a good thing to follow a similar guidance as is given for partial hospital or day treatment?
Yeah, I would say so, as it relates and is, you know, appropriate for your particular setting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. I do have an answer back on a couple of the questions that you all asked me earlier on. If you want me to give that information now, I can. There hasn't been a decision regarding disseminating the work of the advisory groups back out to all accredited organizations. Other than as changes are made, the contributions of the advisory groups would be noted, but there isn't like a formal plan that all of the work that's being done in the advisory group would then be put out for all accredited organizations. It would come out as changes that they recommended were made. And they haven't yet established a formal loop back mechanism from the technical advisory group back to, or the technical advisory committees back to the advisory groups yet, but that's is still under discussion. Okay, and then I think the last outstanding question has to do with the influenza standard, and so I have that out to our standards interpretation group, and so as soon as I get that back, I'll send that to you, Jan. Is that correct?
That's fine.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, thank you. That's good.
Sure.
Are there any other questions, last-minute questions from the group for Julia and Scott? All right.
Thank you for your help.
Thank you. This has been very helpful.
You're welcome.
This was a great call. Thank you so much for your time. We'll be meeting again on March 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Thanks for having us, Dan and Chrissy.
Thank you, Julia and Scott.
Okay. Yep, goodbye.
Bye.